Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have been witnessing, with quite a high drama, the Senate deliberations this past week on the so-called Corker-Cardin legislation that is intended, we're told by its sponsors, to give the Congress some kind of say or vote, at least, on the agreement President Obama is determined to secure with the Iranians. A man who has stood for the constitutional arrangement for that kind of advice and consent by the United States Senate is our guest in this first block of Secure Freedom Radio. He is Senator Ron Johnson, a businessman and accountant by training and practice in his native state of Wisconsin, now the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and also a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Johnson, first of all, let me just express my profound appreciation for your leadership in trying to get the Senate to do its duty by considering this agreement, if it comes as a treaty. Welcome back, sir. It's great to have you with us.
Well, Frank, and appreciate that. You know, I'd like to just start with the main point here. For literally years, I've been hearing presidents of both parties, members of Congress of both parties, you know, just pronouncing that we simply cannot allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, because it's obvious how terrible that is going to be for regional security and world peace. And yet now we have a president who lost the negotiation from the get-go by relaxing sanctions and acknowledging, basically, Iran has a right to enrich uranium, even though UN resolutions dating back to 2006 put sanctions in place, and the only way they were going to be lifted is if Iran suspended or halted their enrichment program. And so, you know, I don't see a good deal coming out of this outcome, and the issues I've been raising is, you know, first we need to understand that this president is so brazen and arrogant that he is entering into these negotiations and entering into an agreement that he's going to, on his own authority, is just an executive agreement. According to our Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, you know, the president does have the power to negotiate treaties between nations, but it is with the advice and consent of the Senate. You know, what's somewhat dubious is, you know, any kind of international agreement that varies from that type of approval process. And Frank, there's no set criteria that says something's a treaty or a congressional executive agreement, or just an executive agreement. That's really based on, you know, what determines that is how it's approved. And so a treaty would be approved by 67 senators in the current makeup, two-thirds of the Senate. A congressional executive agreement would have to be approved by both chambers, both the House and the Senate. And, of course, an executive agreement, which is what this president is claiming this consequential deal with Iran would be, is simply an executive agreement that he can just undertake and commit America to on his own authority. And so I've been trying to highlight what the bill, and listen, the problem Senator Corker has, is he's dealing with Democrats who will only agree to the most minimal role. And I've just been trying to highlight exactly what that means. And let me tell you what it means. It means that a really bad deal with Iran could be approved with basically 34 senators approving it, with the rest of us thinking it's a really bad deal. That is turning advice and consent on its head.
The framers understood that if there weren't this kind of check and balance on executive authority, you would find the Senate being essentially cast aside, the Congress more generally being cast aside, as the president pursues treaties or agreements or other arrangements with foreign powers that could mutate beyond recognition our polity, our republic, our constitution, and so on. And, Senator, I just have to ask, what was it operating, as best you can tell, among the majority, including 11 of your Republican colleagues, that would cause them willingly to participate in this egregious diminution of the power of the institution in which you all serve.
Well, again, let me blame the Democrats. I mean, it's just true. The Democrats are by and large happy, apparently, to let President Obama negotiate this treaty and be done with it. And so at least there are a few Democrats who are willing to say, well, hang on here. You know, involved in this deal is the fact that we have sanctions that were voted on, approved, and, you know, imposed by Congress. And so even though Congress offered this waiver to the president on all these bills that impose sanctions, there was a waiver for national security interests. And, you know, that makes sense. Nobody contemplated that this president would abuse that waiver power the way he's abusing it right now. And so there are a few Democrats that said, you know, we really ought to be involved, but they're only willing to be involved at this just bare minimum level.
And in fact, I think it doesn't do justice to say it's at the bare minimum. As you've indicated, Senator Ron Johnson, it is a Potemkin exercise. You cannot actually really now expect to vote down this agreement under the arrangement that the Corker-Cardin bill represents, does it?
I was really trying to offer three amendments, deeming it a treaty, which needs 67 votes, deeming it an congressional executive agreement. I was even willing to go expedite procedures, so it just required a majority vote. I mean, to me, that's the bare minimum involvement, a majority affirmative vote to approve the deal. I also tried to put in an amendment that actually would clarify what this approval process really was, and I was calling it a low-threshold congressional approval of a treaty. And that would have allowed the deal to be approved with just 34 senators. Now, the parliamentarian appropriately and correctly ruled that out of order, unconstitutional, because you can't pass something with just 34 votes, precisely the point I was trying to make.
Senator, let me just turn this to another topic that's very much related to this. Your friend and mine, Congressman Trent Franks, has observed that the Iranians have recently promulgated a doctrine for their military, which involves, on more than 20 different occasions, a reference to the use of electromagnetic pulse in an attack against the United States. Were Iran to get the bomb, and I personally believe that they are very much determined to do that, and we're legitimating their efforts to do so, and they get the ballistic missiles with which to deliver it here, perhaps long-range ones, as they're getting now, or short-range ones, which they have in abundance delivered off of ships. And we were to see an electromagnetic pulse attack against this country, as you know, it would be devastating to our electric grid and to the nation as a whole. You and I have talked about this before, and I know you have indicated a very strong commitment to trying, as part of your homeland security oversight responsibilities, to get our electric grid made more resilient against these and other kinds of attacks. How important is that, especially if we're witnessing now essentially the green lighting of this nuclear program in Iran?
No, we are whistling past the graveyard. If we don't turn our attention to what we really ought to start doing is provide some measure of protection for our electrical grid. You know, Frank, what drives me crazy is, you know, all the harm, you know, all the information was declassified on EMP. We've known about this for decades when we first started testing nuclear weapons in the South Pacific and the harmful effect on electronics. And we declassified this in 2004 with the commission and then again in 2008. So this was very well known, the danger we faced with a nuclear device that's exploded somewhere up in the atmosphere and how devastating that'd be for electronics and for our electrical grid. I mean, shut it down. And yet, there are some things we could do. For example, we can buy spare transformers, keep them offline and shield them so that they're readily available. Right now, some of these transformers, large ones, they're 2 years in terms of lead time. If we don't have those backup transformers and there's a nuclear attack like that, and again, with this deal, we put Iran on a path to become a nuclear power. They have ballistic missile technology. It's becoming more and more sophisticated. How many years are we away from Iran having not only a nuclear capability, but also the type of intercontinental or satellite technology? Throw up a satellite, let it, you know, with a nuclear weapon in it. I don't want to scare your listeners, but at the same time, we can't bury our head in the sand on this thing. We need to start taking the measures now. And, you know, James Woolsey wrote, a thoughtful piece in the Wall Street Journal talking about a $2 billion price tag. I think that's low. I think he missed that, too. This is kind of a down payment. This provides some protection, some backup. We need to make sure that America collectively admits we have this problem, so there's the political will to address it. You mentioned Trent Franks, and he's been a real leader in the House on that, and I applaud his efforts.
Well, we applaud yours as well and look forward to more of them in the future on this and so many other issues. Again, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, keep it up, sir. Come back to us again if you would. We're very grateful to you. Steve Camarota joins us next on Immigration. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. Adding to the complexity of the current chaos in Syria and Iraq, the Jerusalem Post reported this week that Syria's Assad regime may be on the brink of collapse. Syria has faced 4 years of civil war and 200,000 deaths. Its army has dropped by half. Due to a high rate of casualties and desertions, as well as gains on the ground by rebel fighters, the Syrian military is increasingly relying on foreign fighters, many trained and armed by Iran. The collapse of the Assad government would probably make Syria a greater threat to regional security than it is today, since there is a strong possibility it would be taken over by ISIS and Al-Qaeda and become a terrorist safe haven. The Obama administration's strategy for Syria has been incoherent. It needs to come up with contingency plans in case the Assad government collapses so the country does not become another Iran or Libya. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have with us once again Dr. Stephen Camarota. He is one of the country's go-to guys on matters involving immigration as the director of research for the incalculably important Center for Immigration Studies.
We're very pleased to have him with us. He is frequently cited and heard in other quarters as well, and renders a really important public service with his expertise in matters involving what's happening to America, in part as a result of immigration, and what kinds of policy choices we're making that may have a profound effect on this country today and in its future. Steve Camerota, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks for having me back.
I want to start, I think, maybe with that sort of overall point. You have documented some rather startling statistics from the Census Bureau about the, well, I don't know how else to describe it, but sort of fundamental transformation of America as a result of the cumulative effects of years of American policies in this area. Give us a sense of what that might portend.
Right. Well, what the Census Bureau is telling us is that the roughly 42 million immigrants in the United States is going to continue to grow rapidly, mostly through legal immigration, I should point out. This is something Congress has set. And that by 2023, about one out of every seven U.S. residents will be an immigrant. That is the highest number ever recorded in American history, higher than during the Great Wave of 1880 to 1920. And it doesn't stabilize there. It keeps going. And so by 2060, about 45 years, they project it'll be one out of five U.S. residents, almost 80 million people. And between now and then, there'll also be 40 million births to immigrants. So to give you a sense of the scale of immigration, there'll be about 80 million or almost 80 million immigrants in the U.S. by 2060, absent a change in legal immigration policy, and there'll be about 40 million birthed immigrants over that time period.
And a very substantial percentage of those are going to be over 65 as well, which has its own fiscal and other implications. Stephen Camerota is our guest. He is the director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, a very active contributor to the national policy debate about immigration and the kinds of impacts that it is having. And Steve, you just described what the Census Bureau is projecting. It's really staggering. What would you expect to be the implications for our politics as well as our conduct as a nation if one out of seven of us are foreign born?
Right. Well, I think, and remember that those immigrants have had a lot of children and even some grandchildren, and those children, you know, have every right to vote. They're U.S. citizens, and many of the immigrants have become citizens. And all the research on the two main groups, Asian and Hispanics, who make up about 75% of immigrants, indicates that they and their children tend to like more progressive social policy. So when asked, would you like a government that does more or spends more or does less and spends less, you should get about 2-1 for those populations saying they want a government that does more and spends more. And that's quite a different than what you get when you ask just the general public. So, and there's a whole series of questions, whether it's gun control or regulation of corporations or taxation on the affluent, where what I think you would find is that in general, the policy preferences of immigrants and their children, about 2-1, are for more progressive social policies or more left social policies, if you prefer that term. So what immigration is definitely doing is shifting the national electorate towards the left, towards the Democratic Party. Now, to be clear, what immigrants and their children tend to want is certainly within the mainstream of American politics. It's things like support, strong support for Obamacare, support for gun control, things like that. So it's not like some kind of radical agenda, but it's the Democratic Party. It's you know, center-left of the United States. So what will happen, absent a change in legal, remember this is mostly all legal immigration is just what's doing this, is that the Republican Party, in order to remain politically viable, will have to embrace many of the policies that it now tends to oppose, whether it's more spending, more social programs, more income redistribution, national health care, and things like that. Again, of course, that's what immigration is doing.
Steve Camerota, let me ask you about another population that is coming in substantial numbers, not evidently as large as those you've described, but that has arguably, at least within its ranks, not everyone perhaps, but within its ranks, some who have a decidedly radical agenda, namely replacing the country's existing laws and practices with Sharia. What of the infusion of Muslims from particularly Sharia-adherent nations, and how does that play into this dynamic that you've just described. Is that something that, particularly from a security point of view, we ought to be concerned about?
It's certainly worth thinking about. Again, that immigration is mostly legal, though there is a tiny illegal component of it as well. People sneak across the borders or sometimes come legally and overstay, a temporary visa, tourist, guest worker, that sort of thing. But our green cards, that's permanent legal immigration each year, is about 1.1 million people, and about 10%, about 100,000 of that is based on survey data, are Muslims. So about a million new Muslim immigrants arrive in the United States each decade, and of course people have families and so forth. So what immigration is, of course, doing is dramatically increasing the size of the Muslim community in the United States. And as you observe, that may have national security implications. There certainly have been a number of plots where Muslim immigrants or the children of Muslim immigrants have either planned or actually carried out a terrorist attack.
Notably, just recently, the Boston massacre bombers. Steve, let me just ask you this, because one piece of this, as you say, it is legal, much of it, and that is the flows that are coming in from the refugee programs. I'm told that these are largely now, that is to say, the people who make up the refugees to be resettled in the United States are largely at the direction of the UN, that we've essentially ceded our sovereignty with regard to this to the United Nations. And it is, as you know, largely under the sway of something called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. One of our colleagues, and I think a friend of yours, Ann Corcoran, has just recently done a study for us at the Center for Security Policy about this phenomenon of refugee resettlement being used as a kind of vehicle for the hijra, as they call it, the sort of Muslim colonization. To the extent that the refugee program is as I've described it, is this really skewing the curve further, possibly in a very problematic direction from a national security perspective?
Well, it's certainly true that a significant fraction of Muslim immigrants come in now through refugee, and that represents a choice on our part. But it's also important to understand that our legal immigration system also facilitates large-scale immigration from countries that hadn't generally sent traditionally many immigrants to the United States. Your listeners may not be aware, but we actually run a visa lottery, and we bring in 50,000 people a year who basically electronically put their name on a postcard, send it in, we draw their name out of a hat. So that is a significant source of, say, immigration from the Middle East. Choices we're making in a country like Syria, one of the groups most likely to be in need of resettlement would be Christians. And actually in Canada, they've very much focused on Christians in Syria for their refugee resettlement. We have made a conscious decision not to do that.
And by the way, the FBI has indicated they don't have a way of really vetting the people that would be coming
Absolutely.
In, most of whom are Muslim.
Right. Even when Syria was a country that was together, they wouldn't have cooperated if somebody was a radical anyway and told us. But the bottom line is there's no good records in Syria now. And even when there was widespread corruption and an oppositional regime. So there is absolutely no way to know with any certainty the identity, background, and ideology of the people coming in from a country like that. And that's true of other places like Somalia. There's no records and there's no place to go to really find out much about people. It's not like countries with a highly with a highly efficient bureaucracy. Countries don't even exist then.
Right. It's a it's a ticking time bomb, I think, is what you're describing. And Steve Camerota, we appreciate tremendously what you do at the Center for Immigration Studies to help monitor these situations and hopefully are successful in your testimony on the Hill and effecting some important and overdue changes. Keep up that great work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Congressman Mike Turner joins us. We'll talk with him about the latest developments in the National Defense Authorization Act and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your every day.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 214 years ago, America launched its first foreign military campaign to prevent jihadist piracy on the high seas. Today, America sits idly by as it occurs in the Strait of Hormuz at the hands of jihadist Iran. Recent Iranian harassment of one American ship in those international waters and the seizure of another one it evidently believed was ours are unmistakable provocations. The Obama administration is determined to have nothing impinge upon its pursuit of a nuclear deal with the perpetrators of such latter-day Barbary piracy. By so doing, it is making plain to the Iranians that they can continue upping the ante in the negotiations and engage with impunity in ever more provocative behavior at sea and elsewhere. At some point, that will translate into miscalculations and war. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. I couldn't be more pleased to say, joined once again by an old friend and very much admired member of the House of Representatives. He is Congressman Mike Turner. He serves on both the House Armed Services Committee and on its Intelligence Committee. On the Armed Services Committee, he is the chairman of the Tactical Air and Land Forces Subcommittee and a very influential and leading member of the House of Representatives on national security issues more generally. Congressman, welcome back. It's very good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
You have been at the forefront of those who have been concerned about the threat that is emerging from Iran, of course, in a variety of different fashions, the terrorist threat, the subversion, the ballistic missiles, but also the nuclear weapons. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the so-called deal that is now beginning to take shape, much less concretely than one would like at this point. And your thoughts about how the Congress is likely to deal with it.
I think this the proposed deal is very dangerous. One, it's based upon an assumption that Iran actually does comply with the agreement. And the second aspect of the agreement that's troubling is that the limitations on Iran are insufficient to be able to hold Iran at bay as an emerging threat to the continental United States and to its neighbors. And with respect to the trust aspect, I mean, anything that we've ever known about Iran's program, we have found out through intelligence sources. It's not been any aspect of Iran participating in the international community, declaring their sites, allowing access to their sites, or complying with the treaties that that Iran has been subject to. to make the leap that a country that is a major sponsor of terrorism, that covertly operates throughout the Middle East and has declared itself an existential threat and adversary to both the Israel and the United States is just unthinkable. The second aspect of this deal is that it does not limit Iran's ICBM program or its missile program to that threatens its neighbors or the United States. So Iran will be free to fully over the next decade develop an ICBM that would reach New York or Washington, D.C. And as we all know, people don't develop ICBMs for conventional weapons. So clearly it would be an issue for them to get to the point where they threaten us. The second aspect of the limitations not being sufficient is that they're going to be able to continue to enrich, continue to expand their overall knowledge, and place themselves, in a situation where they're going to be a threat to their neighbors in the United States.
Against this backdrop, and I couldn't disagree with anything you've said. In fact, I worry very much that we've sort of indulged in this illusion that somehow we're going to compartmentalize these threats. What do you make, Congressman Mike Turner, of the prospect that the president would give, in addition to something on the order of $12 billion that has flowed or will by the end of June, to the Iranian regime, another $50 billion by way of a signing bonus on this agreement? Knowing what you do, is there any chance that money will be used for purposes other than intensifying this very problematic behavior in all of the areas you've described, including the nuclear one?
Well, absolutely. And you have a regime that already is undermining all of its neighbors and is seeking weapons of mass destruction. Giving them greater economic opportunity is only going to fuel that. And they're destabilizing Lebanon, what they're doing now in Yemen, throughout that entire region, they pose a threat, and giving them additional resources will only be put to their adventuresomeness.
And emboldening them, really, as well. Among the other things that we have to worry about is evidently in the sort of environment in which sanctions are coming unraveled is the insertion by the Russians at long last, apparently, of advanced air defense missiles, the so-called S-300s. What does that imply, Congressman, in terms of the further danger that this government will represent to us and further limitations on our ability, to say nothing of the Israelis, to do anything about it?
Well, I think it certainly also shows the greater willingness from Russia to support Iran, as Iran is not within the international community, not within the international norms. For Russia to say now that they're receiving pressure for their own violations of international law with Ukraine and their other neighbors, their nuclear investments that they're making that violate the INF Treaty, there will be this military sharing and alliance with Iran that I think does pose, as we look to the future, even a greater threat.
You have been one of the champions in the Congress on missile defenses, Congressman Mike Turner of Ohio. You have helped, I think, establish that even before this Iranian threat metastasizes further, that this is an urgent requirement. I wonder, particularly in connection with your responsibilities on the House Armed Services Committee, how seriously you take evidence that we're now looking at missile threats, perhaps in the not-too-distant future from second- and third-order countries as well, but certainly today from Russia and China, involving things like hypersonic or at least supersonic and even maneuvering warheads. What does that mean for our missile defenses, and should we be doing more in that area?
Well, it certainly poses a difficulty in the issue of missile defense. And I think our investment in directed energy has been thwarted, I think, and we really need to pump that up. There's such great opportunity. What we have learned in missile defense, where we've had to put a bullet on a bullet, the architecture, the algorithms, the geometry, is a significant foundation where we do have the ability to take missile defense to the next step, where with directed energy, we would have an ability to overcome countermeasures, follow and target numerous times incoming dangers. So I do think that that we are in a situation where we have to shift. You know, I just met with Netanyahu and asked him at the end of their very successful deployment of the Iron Dome. I had worked with Israel Iron Dome deployment, and then had returned at the time when it was being deployed. And what are the lessons learned? He said, "Well, the lessons learned are that the threat is evolving, and our missile defense systems have to evolve." And that I think is the real message as we look to the oncoming threats, is that we have a base of knowledge. We now have to take it to the next level.
And we need a president who understands the necessity of doing so, rather than dismantling, as you mentioned, in the directed energy space, the capabilities that have begun to be brought to fruition. Congressman, let me just ask you in closing. You have, of course, just presided over the markup of the Defense Authorization Bill, the so-called National Defense Authorization Act. Is there anything in that legislation this year that you're particularly pleased about and think that the rest of us ought to be aware you've accomplished?
I think probably the most important aspect of the National Defense Authorization Act this year is that we will avoid sequestration. The sequestration has been devastating to our military. It has affected readiness. It has put an environment of uncertainty on our military. And through the budgetary process and then through this National Defense Authorization Act, we will be able to fund the priorities of the military with certainty, without them having to second guess, okay, we have these resources now, what's going to happen as we go through the budgetary process or sequestration? We're at least going to avoid it for this year, which will be fiscal year 2016, and I think fund the priorities to give the military the ability to start recovering from what have been massive cuts and great uncertainty.
And those cuts, I think it's unmistakable. We had one of your colleagues, Congressman Rob Whitman, on earlier in the week talking about the readiness of our forces, and I'm sure you're seeing this in the tactical air and land forces arena as well, are unmistakable in terms of their degradation of our military capabilities. And I can only imagine are contributing to these calculations by the Iranians on the one hand, the Russians, the Chinese, and others, that this is a moment in which they can act, if not with impunity, with a minimal chance that there will be real penalties associated with their misconduct. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Congressman Mike Turner, again, your work in the Armed Services Committee, on the Intelligence Committee, and in the Congress more broadly on these national security matters is tremendously appreciated, of incalculable importance. I suspect you don't get thanked nearly enough for it, but we appreciate you coming by from time to time to allow us to do it, because thanks to you are really very warranted. Next up, we'll be speaking with Bill Gertz. We'll take stock of what's going on inside the ring with him. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by one of the country's preeminent national security correspondents. He is, of course, Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon, where he is a senior editor, and his prize-winning column, the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times, is really required reading in official Washington and those of us who care about national security. Bill Gertz, welcome. It's good to have you with us as always.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Good to have you. Listen, you've got a number of things that touch on the Russian portfolio that I thought we might talk about first. The latest provocation by Russia in terms of aircraft coming into our airspace with perhaps malevolent intent. Talk a bit about that, Bill, and what was done in response.
Yeah, this is an exclusive that appeared on the Free Beacon website today, and it basically reports that Russia, for the first time this year, conducted a provocative Tu-95 bear bomber flights. These are nuclear-capable bombers. They've been flying up against our air defense zones. This one occurred April 22nd along the coast of Alaska. This time, interestingly enough, the Pentagon did not scramble jet fighters to intercept the plane. Makes you wonder whether our funding problems for the military are affecting our operations. I'm sure they are, but I don't think that they would ever admit that. I got some statistics from the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which revealed that there were 10 bomber incursions last year, and 6 of those involved intercepts. In this case, the bombers were detected, but they must have been at a distance where they have determined that they didn't want to send up F-22s to intercept them.
This raises the question as to whether that will encourage more of these kinds of incursions, I should say, and more bad behavior more generally. Bill, the Russians have one other thing that is perhaps headed our way. Talk a little bit about this falling satellite. What do we know about it, and what are the chances that it might actually hit some populated area?
Yeah, this is a very interesting case. The Russians launched a supply satellite that was supposed to send lots of equipment to the International Space Station, where we've got astronauts up there. And for some reason, this spacecraft malfunctioned. It's now tumbling out of control, and it's heading for a reentry with Earth sometime around May 9th. The problem is that it's contained some 3,000 pounds of toxic fuel. The last time this happened was in 2008, and the Pentagon organized a fantastic anti-satellite demonstration by using a missile defense interceptor to shoot down a falling National Reconnaissance Office satellite, which had about 1,000 pounds of toxic fuel. This one has 3,000 pounds. So there's concerns that if the fuel freezes, it could survive reentry and thus pose a hazard to populated areas on Earth.
Hmm. To say nothing of the thing coming down on top of people, that would be a bit of a problem as well. Bill, the House Armed Services Committee, we were just talking in the previous segment with Congressman Mike Turner about some provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. You called attention to two in particular. I'd like you to just talk with us briefly about them. One, dealing with information operations and the need to amp up our capabilities in that area to some extent, especially in light of the very aggressive efforts the Russians are making in that part of the battle space. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is a project of House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mac Thornberry, who recently returned from a fact-finding mission to the Ukraine, where he realized that the Russians are engaged in hybrid warfare. That is, all forms of warfare beyond just kinetic military action, but subversion, political warfare, information warfare. He has added $30 million to the budget of the U.S. Special Operations Command to conduct information operations to counteract this Russian effort. A lot of experts say it's just a drop in the bucket, that the Russians, in fact, the European Command commander said that the Russians are spending $330 million a year in information operations. So it's like 10 times the amount. It's clearly something that has to be addressed. There are going to be hearings on this coming up in the weeks in the House Armed Services Committee.
Well, I know you've been following these issues closely, Bill, and it's really appreciated because I think we fail to understand not only the full extent of these Russian operations, and for that matter, Chinese and other efforts at information dominance, but also how really lacking we are in this space. And hats off to Representative Thornberry for his leadership as well. Bill, there's also language in this bill about the treaty violations by the Russians of the INF Accord. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is very important. It has to do with the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF Treaty, which bans missiles of intermediate range. That's like basically 186 miles to about 300 miles. And the Russians have violated this treaty. They've deployed a new ground-launched cruise missile, and it's a militarily significant violation. The Obama administration has completely ignored this violation. It's been known since 2013, and yet the administration's response to Congress has been, well, we're studying our options. Well, again, the House Armed Services Committee has added language that calls for the Pentagon to conduct a military response to this violation, and that includes developing missile defenses against it or going the furthest step, which would be to deploy nuclear-tipped intermediate-range missiles in Europe.
Very important stuff, and I'm hopeful that the Congress will, in fact, prevail on some kind of sensible retaliatory practice against the Russians, because if we don't, you can bet there will be even more of this and more insidious at that. Bill, let me ask you about another issue you've been following, and we were speaking about satellites falling from space a moment ago. Space warfare is an area in which we are now, I think, increasingly confronted with evidence that the Chinese, notably the Russians and perhaps others, are exercising more and more ambitious efforts. And talk a bit about what that's resulting in terms of our own capabilities.
Yes, just this past weekend, the Air Force Space Command went public with its efforts to counteract what they're calling the high frontier of threats, basically from Russia, China, other spacefaring nations are developing anti-satellite capabilities, which pose a massive risk to our strategic assets. Everything from getting money from an ATM machine to television images to military command and control goes through satellites. This General John Hyten, who's the commander of the Space Command, he said that we are now facing a situation where U.S. satellites are threatened at every level, not just at the 100-mile level above space, but all the way out to 22,000 miles in geosynchronous orbit. It's a major threat. The administration has taken, again, a very passive approach to it. The only thing they're looking at is jamming and maneuvering of satellites, whereas the Chinese and Russians have missiles that can blow up satellites.
Yeah, and boy, Bill, this general sounded to be fairly robust. It sounds like the kind of man we need in that job at this moment in time, for sure. I hope he gets the resources he needs to do his job. Bill, lastly, very quickly, the president apparently gave assurances to Prime Minister Abe that the United States would honor its defense commitments in the event there were problems with the Senkakus. In light of what we've seen of late in terms of a failure of American resolve in meeting its defense commitments, notably with Ukraine, and now these this ship being taken hostage by Iran, how do you think we're likely to be seen in making those kinds of commitments?
This was a very important statement by the president. It was largely overlooked by the mainstream media. I did a piece on it in the Free Beacon. The president invoked Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Defense Treaty, which said that the Senkaku Islands, which China is claiming as the Diaoyu Islands, are in fact covered by the defense treaty. It's very important. It doesn't seem that way from the U.S. perspective, but from the Japanese perspective, this is the kind of commitment that Shinzo Abe, the conservative Japanese prime minister, is really picking up the ball in terms of regional security leadership in Asia. And it was the Japanese that really sought a more explicit confirmation of this defense guidelines, even though critics have pointed out that the president has made numerous red lines and allowed them to be crossed in the past. But I think it is an important commitment.
Bill Gertz, as always, thank you so much for your time and your efforts to report on all of these issues. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again next week, as I hope we will the rest of you. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.